Good morning. Is this working? Can you hear me? Yeah, sounds, oh, there we go. All right, good morning, everyone. We're excited to be here at Boyd Law School for oral argument. Thanks for joining us. We've got some great cases, and we hope you enjoy the arguments. So with that, we're going to start with our first case, which is Wallace versus Smith, case number 70574. I would ask all the counsel, when you come up to the podium, make sure that you introduce yourself for the clerk of the court and introduce your counsel or your clients. And having said that, I'll ask the appellant, Mr. Phillips, did you want any time for rebuttal argument as the appellant? How much time would you like?
Your Honor, I would like to have at least half of the time. I'm going to be real short.
Okay. So about 7.5 minutes, I guess. Is that going to work for you? Great. Yes. You may.
Your Honor, my name is David Lee Phillips. I'm bar number five, my bar number is 538. At my table is Mr. Charles Brown and Robert Rose. They're not licensed lawyers here, but they work in my office, and they worked on this case, and they're helping me. In the audience is my client, Tanya Wallace, and her family. So, Your Honor, this case coming back here today, this is like deja vu. We were here before a few years back, and it's good to be back. I guess it's good to be back, I should say. Your Honor, we have several issues. We've outlined them quite well. We've done some very deep and extensive research on this case. We believe that we're extremely strong on it, on the issues, strong on the research, and we would stand on that. And we would ask that the that this court remand this matter, or give us a ruling favorable to my client, and remand this matter for trial.
So, Mr. Phillips, let me ask you a question that the parties didn't brief, but it's jurisdictional. Okay, how does Tanya Wallace have standing to appeal this case by herself when her interest in this case is derivative through her deceased husband, ex-husband?
Your Honor, during the course of this case, the parties all agreed. There was a stipulation that she would become an intervener with her own claims and the like.
But the standard for intervention is lower. All you have to show under Rule 24 is that you may have an interest. That gets you into the case, and then if you don't have an interest, that's the subject of future litigation. So I'm asking the next step, which is, okay, so the district court found that she may have an interest. I'm asking you now, does she have an interest?
She does have an interest. Her interest is the same as the estate. She did everything right. Everybody agreed that she would become a party in this case, and she had her own independent rights. It's all it's well outlined in the transcripts, where Mr. Butte and Ms. Lee agreed that she had her own rights and she could litigate her own issues.
Well, why? What arguments can you really put forth that this wasn't a good faith settlement by the district court judge? I mean, here, the estate has every reason to get the most money out of NEO or the other side. So to get the most money out, and arguably the state and Mr. Smith come together, they find an amount that appears to be an arm's length transaction. I mean, your client gets 50% of it. Don't they have every interest, the estate, to get the most bang for their buck? And if so, I mean, how would the district court have abused its discretion by granting the good faith settlement? I mean, what can you point to that would be something contrary to that?
Your Honor, we took, the court and me have read the transcript from the deposition. We took Mr. Smith Neo's deposition. In that deposition, he admitted that he'd made quite a bit more money. He had one contract with Def Jam Records that paid him $4 million a year for 6 years. It was a six-year contract. He was able to then barter that or negotiate a buyout for, through Motown. They bought out a good portion of the contract after he had worked it.
Wasn't that Neo? That wasn't Envy.
That was Neo.
Wasn't Envy the underlying contract with the management with your client's ex-husband?
It was joint and several. They represented all of the parties individually and as a group. And he had made the money. Trish Lee and her company and her office did not even read. They set the deposition. The whole idea of the deposition to see what was his earnings, what was his value, what was he, his net worth, so that we could get this matter done. She did not. They didn't show up for their own deposition. We went. We did it. We took it. We were ready to go. When we got back for the on the motion for reconsideration, that's when they negotiated for $60,000, and I believe she put on the record that their fees were probably four or five times that. $60,000 was not even enough in this case. Okay, I yield, and would like to save my time.
You'd like to save it? Sure.
Yes.
Do you have any questions, Judge Stevens?
No. Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. James Freeman on behalf of Schaefer Smith. I'm here with Kelly Dove of Snell and Wilmer, a local counsel. We've been at this case now for 7 years. This is our second time here. It's nice to be here. It's a beautiful day for oral argument. So I wanted to start with the issue of the interpretation of the contract, because our good faith settlement was based on the district court's ruling that the management commissions, if any, were measured by the monies or other consideration actually received by Smith in his capacity as a member of Envy between October 2nd of 2001 and March 6th of 2005. Now, if we go back to the Supreme Court's ruling 4 years ago, the Supreme Court, on its first page of the decision, it already interpreted this exact provision. It says, quote, "The agreement required Wallace to provide his professional management services for 7 years and required Smith to pay Wallace 15% of his earnings, if any, weekly for 7 years. It doesn't say weekly for perpetuity. What they've been arguing, and the reason why they objected to the good faith settlement, was because of the price. The estate and Smith were arguing, were negotiating for about 6 months in the four-figure range. Tanya Wallace and his counsel were seeking in excess of $1 million, and quite frankly, tens of millions of dollars, because they're saying that they're entitled to 15% of all the money that my client has ever earned and will ever earn for the rest of his life and the life of his heirs. That's their argument. The Supreme Court has already held it's a seven-year contract. We spent a lot of time and resources on the motion for summary judgment to secure the ruling to cap the damages, because we knew that if we capped the damages, we'd be able to settle the case right before trial. That was the whole object. So they participated in the settlement negotiations.
They were there with Judge Escobar?
Exactly, on January 29th.
They were there with Judge Escobar at the settlement conference?
Yes, they were. They were there. It was a seven-hour conference. Judge Escobar went back and forth into both rooms. She educated both the parties in terms of strengths and weaknesses of the case.
And were they sitting there with the estate at the time?
They were.
With the estate.
I wasn't in the room with them, obviously. I was
right
in our own room.
You had caucused off into another room.
Precisely. But they were there. They were present. We came out of that settlement discussion, you know, substantially far apart. We had already briefed our motion for summary judgment. It wasn't until about March. Again, the trial date was set for May 9th. It was about March that we started to negotiate again. And then, of course, as the trial date approached, the negotiations, we began to meet in the middle somewhere, and it looked like it was going to be feasible for a settlement. All in the meanwhile, David Phillips was, you know, saying this is not acceptable. You know, this is millions of dollars. We're entitled to, you know, commission 15% of everything that Neo's ever earned, and you guys are talking about just this, you know, pittance that he earned between, 2001 and 2005. But it was a seven-year contract. The whole reason why the Supreme Court reversed on the initial ruling that it was barred by the statute of limitations was because it determined that it was an installment contract, meaning that Smith was required to make periodic installments for 7 years, and the statute of limitations would re-trigger each week that the payments weren't made. So how can you have an installment contract for 7 years that goes into perpetuity? Those two concepts are completely oppositional. You can't have an installment contract that goes forever. I would even argue it's constitutionally suspect, because you don't have, I mean, because then it becomes like a contract of indentured servitude, where you're just basically for life, you have to pay out royalties to a manager who, the record shows, never actually put a dollar into my client's pocket.
Well, let me take you another direction. One of the issues is an abuse of discretion, whether or not the district court abuses discretion by failing to reconsider the grant of summary judgment, because at the time, the district court had allowed Mr. Phillips to come in and intervene, mm-hmm. but he didn't get a chance to formally oppose the motion for summary judgment. And he wasn't a party to the action at the time of summary judgment. So under those facts, why do we not say that the district court should have granted reconsideration in looking at that summary judgment?
Your Honor, respectfully, I'd like to correct the record on that. They actually did make a motion for consideration in April of 2016, and the court did consider the motion for reconsideration, including the district court also paid reference to the expert report which they attached, because they were trying to introduce an expert report to show that there's industry custom and practice for post-term compensation.
But they weren't a party to summary judgment before. They hadn't been allowed to intervene, they didn't have an opportunity to oppose that motion for summary judgment.
Right,
and therefore, why is it not an abuse of discretion, despite the expert report?
Oh, because I was saying, because we made the motion for summary judgment January 15th.
And they were not a party.
No.
They didn't oppose it.
No, but they were granted intervener status on February 24th. And then on April 11th, I believe it was, they made a motion for reconsideration on the summary judgment. So in other words, they had an opportunity to be heard on that very issue. They got
a second
bite. But
they didn't
have
an opportunity on the summary judgment.
They had a motion for reconsideration, the court's ruling on summary judgment. So I'm saying they had an option. They had the opportunity to brief the very issue that we originally briefed back in January. And the court simply re-upped and said, I've considered your arguments and I reject them, because...
So you're saying the district court determined on the merits the summary judgment through the reconsideration.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. And that ruling was in April of 2016. And I could even say, if you give me a minute. Yeah, so she said, this is on their appendix 3, ROA 540. And this was her motion for reconsideration, which I believe was actually May 3rd of 2016. There is no reasonable interpretation of paragraph 4 that would support Ms. Wallace's expert conclusion that the amount of recoverable fees is not limited to monies or other considerations received solely during the relevant time frame. This conclusion stands in direct opposition to the unambiguous language of paragraph 4. So she considered their motion for reconsideration, and she even considered, even though we objected to the admissibility and foundation of the expert report, she actually also considered the expert report and says, yeah, I mean, you can't use parole evidence or an expert report to vary the terms of a written contract. You can use it as a gap filler on like an oral agreement if the term has never been discussed. But when you have language that says it's a 7-year contract, and you have an expert report that comes in saying, well, it might be a 7-year contract, but we get royalties in perpetuity beyond the 7 years, the district court simply said, no, you can't use the expert report to vary the terms of the contract. So they got a fair ruling on that. So what their abuse of discretion, where they're coming on the abuse of discretion, is tied to the interpretation of the contract. They're saying that the judge misinterpreted the contract, that she should have ruled that it was ambiguous and made it a question of fact, and because of that, she abused her discretion in granting the good faith settlement. Now, that creates a very interesting issue, because we settled the case on the basis of the district court's ruling. That's good faith. Even if the district court erred, you could still make an argument that it was a good faith, because we were basing it on what the district court decided. And like we said, we committed a lot of resources to obtaining that ruling. So the abuse of discretion is a very, very high standard for them to meet here, because we were negotiating in good faith based on what the district court had already ruled.
So, counsel, let me ask you the same question I asked your counterpart here. Under Rule 24, intervention is appropriate if a party may have an interest in the litigation and that is not adequately represented by another party, which courts have interpreted to mean they have a divergent interest than somebody else in the case. If her interest is the same as Wallace, how is she in this case?
She's in this case because the probate commissioner awarded, back in December 2011, awarded Ms. Wallace, as a part of the divorce decree, 50% interest in the proceeds of the litigation.
But she's not a signatory to the contract.
Correct. She's not a signatory to the contract.
Let me ask you this. She couldn't have sued Schaefer Smith Neo herself.
Correct. There's no privity of contract.
So how can she appeal this without David Wallace?
Well, we made a motion to dismiss the this appeal to the Supreme Court for lack of jurisdiction. And the court dismissed and said, well, it was really a formality. She had standing to sue because she was granted intervener status by the district court. It's more of like a proceeding. So
here's the question. Usually when you're granted intervener status, what you do then is file a complaint in intervention. What claims is she a party to?
That's the problem. Ms. Wallace never filed a complaint in intervention, and that was part of why we said we should get a motion to dismiss. We don't know what Ms. Wallace's claims are.
Didn't the district court orally grant a motion to intervene?
Yes.
So, I mean, at the end of the day, the district court did grant intervener status.
Yes, and we did not.
Despite not a written
correct
motion.
Correct.
Or complaint.
And we did not object because we knew that, what's the point? The probate commissioner granted her 50% interest. She had an interest to be there procedurally. And that's the key thing about intervention. Just because you're an intervener doesn't mean you acquire substantive rights. It means you acquire procedural rights to participate. They've sort of conflated the issue and says, oh, well, because we're an intervener, we now have independent cause of action against Smith. No, you don't. No, Ms. Wallace does not have any independent cause of action against Smith because there's no privity of contract, number one. And number two, her claims would be time-barred in any event because the Supreme Court held that you have to sue from 6 years from the date of the final installment. So had she wanted to assert, let's say, assuming for the sake of argument that there was privity of contract, that she was a party to the agreement, whatever claim she had to have been brought before October 2nd of 2011, which is 6 years after the last installment payment. She waited 5 years beyond that. So her claims were time barred, and the district court's ruling on July 21st, which was her final judgment, she said that the claims would have been time barred in any event. The district court said, number one, there's no privity of contract. You don't have an independent cause of action. Number two, even if you did, it's time barred. So we don't believe. So the question of whether or not she has standing, I think, is a procedural matter. We're not going to object to that. Ms. Wallace is entitled to her day in court by virtue of the probate commissioner's ruling.
I mean, how can you concede that? What claim in any complaint is she the plaintiff or defendant on?
She's not. Correct.
So how is she aggrieved by any judgment of the district court if she's not even a party to any claim in the action?
Well, she's not. Well, the reason why, that's a very question. I mean, the reason why she would be aggrieved potentially because she's entitled to 50% of the proceeds from the litigation. I think, you know, she's entitled to maximize the value of the case, and I give them that. She's entitled to maximize the value of the case. But how does she maximize the value of the case? By participating, by being present, by making sure that there's no, you know, funny business or fraud or collusion. They've made allegations of fraud or collusion. I've had a very cordial relationship with my opposing counsel for 7 years. We put them on notice of everything that was happening. It had nothing to do with any procedural issue. It was the substantive merits. They thought they got 10, you know, they should get 10 million. We're negotiating between 15 grand and 90 grand. So it's very difficult for us to negotiate with an intervener who's looking for a huge windfall that has no relation to the merits of the case. So it was never, there was no fraud, no collusion. We put them on notice of everything that we were doing at the deposition of Mr. Smith on April 22nd. We talked settlement. We said, look, we're in the four-figure range. It looks like this is going to happen. He's like, we're never going to agree to that. You know, we're entitled to whatever songs he wrote during the contract period, we're entitled to royalties in perpetuity. That's not what the contract says. So,
Mr. Freeman, it still would have been a much more significant amount than $60,000. So Mr. Phillips' point is that why settle for a low amount if the fees for the cost of litigation are going to subsume whatever the settlement is? So this situation comes up for us more typically in a personal injury case. Let's say you have a settlement for $60,000, but the medical bills are $100,000. Mm. And the court has to decide whether there was a good faith offer for $60,000 when awarding attorney's fees. What do you do? I mean, when the client really doesn't get anything because of the cost.
I mean, I understand the point. I can relate to it. But there's one thing we're overlooking here, and that's the issue of liability. This is not a clear-cut case to damages here. We have a lot of strong affirmative defenses here, number one being that it was Mr. Wallace himself who breached the contract. We were justified in firing him and therefore excused from the breach. We have a very strong argument that the intentions of the parties were to engage in a group contract. These were 18, 17-year-old boys who were in a tight-knit unit. They thought they were entering into a group contract. It had nothing to do with the solo careers. We also have a strong argument of statute of limitations still, a mutual abandonment. So anytime you settle a case, you have to look at your gambling. What are the odds that you're going to lose on liability and get zero? So my argument to you is $60,000 might seem nothing to them. To us, it seems like we're paying $60,000, but we could have won. We shouldn't have had to pay anything. So we're looking at it more as a litigation avoidance cost.
Right, and that certainly makes sense, plus with the rulings you received from the district court. So is this more like a nuisance settlement then?
I would say that it's a combination of litigation avoidance cost. We didn't want to go through, you know, we would have had to spend probably $150,000 to go to trial. We would have had to fly in five witnesses from L.A. It would have been, you know, we say 3 to 5 days. There probably would have been another appeal no matter which way it went. So settlements are about certainty. They're about eliminating uncertainty and about avoiding the cost of litigation and about looking at the strengths and weaknesses of the case and deciding, okay, where are we at? We did not want to go to trial in this case. We did not want to spend the money. We have two law firms involved. And as your honors have seen, we've attached Mr. Smith's IRS statements from the operative period. So it showed that he made $350,000. I guess my time's up. But
thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Phillips.
Thank you. May I start now?
Sure.
Counsel mentioned that there was a settlement conference. Of course, there was one set. All the parties were told to be there. But my client and the personnel from my office were told to wait outside. Normally, you would split up the parties, and the mediator arbitrator would talk to one side, then talk to another. They sat outside the court for 2 hours. Now, 2 hours after everybody else had left, they were not allowed to. Our client was not allowed to participate in the settlement conference.
But you weren't a party to the auction then.
No,
you were notified of it.
Right, right. And we were asked to come in and see if we could, because it was going to be a global settlement.
Right.
And we were there. Our people were there and were not allowed to participate.
Did you submit a mediation brief to the
mediator?
I believe
we did. We did everything by the book, I know. So I can only say that we did everything by the book that would have been preparing some document for the mediator.
Well, you did everything by the book, but I heard counsel, and I wrote it down, say that they put you on notice of every single issue. And in fact, did you not? You were the one that actually filed the original complaint on behalf of Mr. Wallace, right?
That's correct.
So why then, if you're put on notice of every single event, do you not file a written opposition to the motion for summary judgment in the district court level before she makes her ruling on what your contract amount is going to be at trial?
We were not, because the estate had come in on the
right.
case, and we were out there. They had new counsel on the case.
Right.
They were representing the estate. I represented Mrs. Wallace and her two minor children.
But you showed up at the hearing.
Yes.
You walk in and you say
right.
to the judge, stop the press. We'd like to intervene right now.
Right.
And you actually did an oral motion intervene,
right.
which was granted.
Right.
Why? In anticipation of that hearing, did you not file a written motion opposing summary judgment? Why didn't you do that?
We were not party at that time, and I know we could have done something, tried to file something. It would have been a fugitive document. We were not in the case at that time. But we did come in, Your Honor. We did.
Was it accurate what Mr. Freeman said when you filed your motion for reconsideration? You, in essence, got to argue against the summary judgment?
I don't. No, I don't think that is correct. No, that is not correct. We did argue. She did allow us to argue. We did argue. We made some points on the record about it. We opposed it. It was all, as I recall, at that point in time, we had already been allowed to intervene into the case. We got there, and the court at that point asked us if we'd taken the deposition of of Neo and done some discovery, and we had, and we were ready to go to trial. Then she made her ruling that, the contract says monies actually received. And I believe at that time I argued that, no, there is other consideration, and what we filed what our expert had filed. The other consideration means royalties, investments, and other forms of value in the entertainment industry. So at that point in time, she ruled against us. We were allowed to come in the case as an intervener with all rights, but we couldn't do anything. We were pretty much neutered at the time.
Intervention isn't about intervening in an event like a motion. It's
absolutely
intervening in a lawsuit.
Absolutely.
If you didn't think that, if you thought she had an interest in the lawsuit from the beginning, why didn't you intervene much earlier? Why did you wait until there was a brief summary judgment motion and then try to intervene in a motion? Why weren't you in the case from the beginning if there was an interest to be protected by intervention in the first place?
We had participated in every level of this case until we were ordered out by the court, that we were not a party to court. We tried to get in through the probate commissioner. We tried to get in and through the district court here, and at that point in time, everybody agreed. Everybody stipulated that my client, Tanya Wallace, could come in with her own claims, and that she could participate as an intervener. The court ordered it, and then when we got that to the reconsideration, we were not allowed. The other issues I wanted to bring up is that the intervener status has the divorce action where my client was awarded half of the proceeds from this case, and the fact that she was a partner in this venture with her husband at the time that he was alive and they were married and they were going through this matter. The probate court did not make a finding that she was a partner in this case. For whatever the reason was, but she did make her position known, and as well as when we brought up the issues on regarding the contract issues that as to what consideration was, that's a big part of our case. I mean, we've cited cases like the Kudrow case out of California. It's a seminal case on issues like custom and usage. You bring in outside information to explain, or as counsel said, it's a filler to fill in some of the blank spots on what consideration is and what other consideration is in the industry. It's been around for years. That's the way. A lot of people in the industry are compensated. And then again, on the good faith settlement, we believe that it was willfully lacking. And because of this, we would ask that the issues on the summary judgment be, we'd ask that there be a finding that there are fact issues that genuine issues of fact that should be determined at the time of trial. We submit it.
Thank you. All right. Well, this case will now.